January 28, 2008, Little Rock, Arkansas. 45-year-old John Glasgow leaves his home and fails to show up for work, so he's subsequently reported missing. The following day, John's abandoned SUV is discovered in a parking lot at Petit Jean State Park over 70 miles away, but an extensive search fails to find him, and rumors circulate that John's disappearance may be linked to an audit which is taking place at his workplace. In 2015, John's skeletal remains are discovered at the base of a cliff only 1 mile from where his vehicle was found, but a cause of death cannot be determined, and no one can figure out what happened to him. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Werder, and today, we're going to be exploring a missing persons case involving a victim who eventually turned up deceased. The unexplained 2008 death of John Glasgow. This is a case which was featured during the second season of Disappeared, and was one of the very first episodes of the show I recall having seen. And it has also turned out to be one of those frustrating disappearances in which the victim's remains were eventually found, but we still have no idea how they died or if foul play actually took place. At the time he went missing, John lived in Little Rock, Arkansas, and was the chief financial officer of a construction management firm called CDI Contractors, but he failed to show up for work one morning, and a neighbor would report having seen John's SUV driving away from his house much earlier than he usually left. The following day, the abandoned and unlocked SUV was discovered in a parking lot at Petit Jean State Park, and many of John's personal items were left inside. But since this location was over 70 miles away from Little Rock, no one could figure out why John would have driven there. A search of the park failed to turn up any trace of John, but in March of 2015, his skeletal remains were discovered at the base of a cliff on Petit Jean Mountain in a very rugged, remote area that hikers were not known to frequent. Since there were no obvious signs of trauma on John's skull, the medical examiner was unable to determine his exact cause of death, so it's unclear if he was the victim of a homicide, suicide, or accidental fall. What we do know is that John was experiencing a great deal of stress at the time he went missing, as a massive forensic audit was taking place at CDI Contractors, and even though John had an impeccable reputation for being an honest man who was exceptional at his job, he was facing allegations of potential financial misdeeds. If these allegations were true, this could have provided a potential motive for suicide, but in the end, no evidence was ever found to indicate that John did anything illegal or unethical. But on the other hand, could John have uncovered some improprieties which put his life at risk and caused him to become the victim of foul play? All we do know is that it's been 9 years since John's remains were discovered, and all media coverage of this case seems to have ground to a halt, so I thought now would be a good time to put together an episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early accessed episodes, and bonus content. As our Patreon page has around 70 exclusive bonus episodes in our archives, which are not available on a regular feed. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the unexplained death of John Glasgow. Thank you. Our story begins in Little Rock, Arkansas in 2008, and our central figure is 45-year-old John Glasgow. Originally born in the small town of Nashville, Arkansas, John was the youngest of eight children and maintained close relationships with his siblings, who often described him as the glue that held the family together. After graduating from the University of Central Arkansas with a Master of Business Administration, John became licensed as a certified public accountant and was assigned by his accounting firm to perform an outside audit on CDI contractors. CDI is a multi-million dollar firm based out of Little Rock, which provides construction services all over the United States and has been responsible for such projects as the William J. Clinton Presidential Library and Museum. CDI was so impressed by John's auditing work that they decided to hire him in 1990, and within 5 years, he was promoted to the position of Chief Financial Officer. After one failed marriage, John got married to his second wife, Melinda Glasgow, whom he had known since the sixth grade. The two friends had gone their separate ways when they went off to college, but after Melinda went through one failed marriage of her own and had a son named JT, she eventually reconnected with John and they started a relationship. At this particular point, the couple had been married for 16 years and lived together in a house on South Lookout Street, located in some hills just outside of Little Rock. John is known for being very devoted to his wife, stepson, and cat, Simon, and since he now draws a seven-figure salary at CDI and has an impeccable reputation, he seems to be living the ideal life. However, CDI is currently going through a major transitional period as their original founder, Bill Clark, died of cancer in May of 2007. CDI has always had a joint partnership with the department store magnate Dillard's, and the firm has constructed a number of the company's stores. Following Bill Clark's death, his half-interest in the company passed on to his widow, Margaret, and son, William Clark, who became the new chief executive officer. CDI entered negotiations with Dillard's to purchase Bill's half of the company, but before this deal could go through, Dillard's wanted to perform a complete forensic audit of CDI in order to ensure that their financials were clean. I'll go into more details about this later on, but this audit was creating a great deal of stress for John and causing him to fall behind on his regular tasks at CDI. As a result, on the weekend of January the 26th and 27th, John spent a lot of extra hours working at the CDI office, which was located only about a mile away from his residence. According to Melinda, John came home for his lunch break on the 27th, but she said that he appeared to be quite exhausted and distracted. After taking a nap on the couch, John returned to his office to do a couple more hours worth of work, but when evening hit, he and Melinda attended a party being hosted by one of John's cousins who lived across the street from them. Melinda said that John appeared to be having a good time before they returned home. By the time Melinda was ready for bed at 10:30 p.m., she noticed that John had fallen asleep in a chair in front of the TV with his cat Simon resting on a blanket on his lap. She decided to leave him there before she headed upstairs, but this turned out to be the last time she ever saw her husband alive. When Melinda woke up on the morning of Monday, January the 28th, she discovered that John was not in bed or in his chair, but since his gray 2005 Volvo SUV was not parked outside, she figured he had simply woken up earlier than usual to head to work. Melinda then headed to work herself, but at around 2:30 p.m., she received a phone call from one of John's co-workers who informed her that John had not shown up at the CDI office that day and they were unable to reach him on his company-issued cell phone. Melinda became concerned when she cannot reach John on his cell phone either, so she soon met up with John's oldest brother, Roger Glasgow, and they both started calling around to friends and family to see if anyone knew where John was. They eventually spoke to one of their next-door neighbors, who claimed he had seen John's Volvo SUV driving away from his residence at 5:15 a.m. that morning. The neighbor said he did not actually see John and could not confirm he was the one driving the SUV, but Melinda found the situation very unusual since John ordinarily did not leave for work that early. When John failed to resurface, Melinda finally contacted the Little Rock Police Department shortly before 6 p.m. in order to officially report him missing. Melinda noticed that John had written down their joint bank account number and the combination to their home safe on a page of a notepad which belonged to her and was resting on the kitchen counter next to the phone. The notepad was also resting next to some checks which John had filled out and needed to be mailed. The checks were dated that morning and were written from a family educational trust, with one of them written to one of John's nieces, while the other one was written by John to himself to cover his trustee's fee. However, Melinda found it odd that John would have written down their bank account number and the safe combination, as she already knew that information, and when she checked inside the home safe, nothing appeared to be missing. The safe contained John and Melinda's passports and $11,400 in cash, though Melinda felt that this was a larger amount of cash than what was usually kept in there. Since John's cell phone had been issued to him by CDI, Melinda was able to convince their CEO, William Clark, to make arrangements to track the phone. William was friends with the CEO of Altel, the company who provided CDI with their phones, and they were able to determine that the last electronic ping on John's phone took place at 7:22 a.m. on the morning of the 28th, and it pinged off a cell tower in a rural area of Conway County, about 60 miles northwest of Little Rock. On January the 29th, Roger and one of his friends drove out to this area to search for John, but couldn't find any trace of him or his SUV. But later that day, the SUV was discovered in the parking lot of a tourist attraction known as Mather Lodge, which is located in the 3,400-acre Pettigean State Park. The park is situated on top of Pettigean Mountain, just over 70 miles northwest of Little Rock, and was a spot that John had visited in the past. The Conway County Sheriff's Office soon arrived at the scene and learned that John had not registered at Mather Lodge. The SUV was unlocked, John's personal debit card was inside the glove compartment, and his sunglasses were lodged between the dashboard and the stick shift. A laptop case was also inside the vehicle, and it contained a number of items which had all been issued to John by CDI, including a laptop computer, cell phone, electronic office key, corporate credit card, and gas card. It turned out that a tourist staying at the lodge had taken a pair of photographs of the area at around 4:30 p.m. on January the 28th, and since the SUV could be seen in the background and it was parked in the same spot, this confirmed that it arrived there on the same day John went missing. The approximate time it would have taken to drive from John's residence in Little Rock to the Mather Lodge was 1 hour and 15 minutes. But since the SUV was seen leaving at 5:15 a.m., and John's cell phone pinged off the cell tower in Conway County at 7:22 a.m., this left nearly an additional hour of time which cannot be accounted for. The authorities performed a check of surveillance footage taken by security cameras from various businesses located near Pettigean State Park, but they were unable to turn up any footage of John or his SUV in the area. And since there were no witnesses who could confirm having seen John at the park, investigators could not even be 100% certain he was the one who drove the SUV there. Regardless, there was hope that the stress surrounding John's issues at work had compelled him to drive to Pettigean State Park in order to hike the trails and blow off some steam, so the park's search and rescue team launched a massive search operation. Bloodhounds were brought in, with hopes that they could pick up John's scent from the SUV and follow it into the park. But since the first day of the search contained a lot of heavy winds and rain, this may have hampered the dog's ability to track John's scent, as they kept losing it before they could travel very far. In total, the search effort lasted 3 days, but no trace of John could be found anywhere in the park. The Arkansas State Police became involved in the investigation and impounded the SUV for a forensic search, but surprisingly, they failed to turn up any usable fingerprints in the vehicle, not even prints belonging to John. There would be no further activity on John's bank account and personal credit card, but investigators still looked into the possibility that he may have walked away voluntarily. Indeed, in the weeks following his disappearance, there were reported sightings of John at a Phillips 66 gas station and a Waffle House restaurant in the town of Russellville, located about 25 miles northwest of Pettigean State Park. John's disappearance captured the attention of the VK9 Scent-Specific Search and Recovery Unit, a search team in Maine who offered to have their bloodhounds perform their own search of the park for John. After the Glasgow family hired the unit's services, they traveled to Arkansas, but failed to find anything during the search of Pettigean State Park. However, one of the unit's bloodhounds, Quincy, was able to track John's scent to the convenience store at the Phillips 66 gas station in Russellville, where John had supposedly been seen weeks earlier. Quincy then followed John's scent from there to a nearby Comfort Inn, and it turned out that the Waffle House where John was seen was only 50 yards away from the motel. In spite of this, investigators were unable to find anything that tied John to these locations or conclusively proved that he ever traveled to Russellville. Interestingly enough, Quincy also picked up John's scent at the driveway of the Dillard's corporate office in Little Rock, but since John had gone to this building for a meeting in late December of 2007, and no one knew how old the scent was, this did not prove that John went there on the day he went missing. Regardless, investigators still looked into the possibility that John's disappearance was somehow connected to the negotiations between Dillard's and CDI. I mentioned earlier that following the death of founder Bill Clark in 2007, CDI was hoping to work out a deal with Dillard's in which they would purchase and redistribute Bill's 50% share in the company, with 3/5 of it going to his son, William Clark, and the other 2/5 being split between John and 9 other executives. But before the deal could go through, Dillard's hired some external auditors from a company in Kansas City to perform their own review of CDI's bookkeeping, which, given John's impeccable 12-year record as the company's CFO, really rubbed him the wrong way. The audit was implemented by Dillard's chief financial officer, James Freeman, who showed up at John's office one day and delivered what John considered to be a hostile interrogation about such topics as the size of bonuses given out to CDI executives and the fees they were charging to Dillard's. In early January of 2008, John tried to relieve some of his stress by leaving on a ski vacation to Colorado with Melinda and some of his siblings, but they noticed that he seemed depressed and worried. At one point, he told his brother Roger that CDI always had a solid system in place for their accounting practices, but he was upset that Dillard's was attempting to implement a new system which could screw things up. But Roger said that after giving his brother a pep talk about the situation, John started to cheer up and enjoyed the vacation. After John returned to work, things initially seemed to be going fine, and he also received a career-best $300,000 bonus from CDI, who had just enjoyed their most profitable year ever with revenues of $580 million. However, on January the 18th, John received what he considered to be an upsetting phone call at work from James Freeman. According to John, Freeman seriously questioned his integrity and made remarks about how CFOs were generally the people who went to jail whenever a company committed financial misdeeds. Freeman also allegedly made reference to the Enron accounting scandal by stating, quote, "You know the CFO there? He lost his license. He went to prison. Well, that's what's going to happen to you," end quote. When John informed William Clark about what happened, this immediately prompted him to hold an emergency meeting between CDI and Dillard's in an attempt to iron out their differences. During the meeting, Freeman denied having made those threats to John over the phone, but he then launched into accusations about how CDI had overbilled Dillard's and covered it up. Later that night, John returned home and spoke to Melinda about the situation. He expressed his disappointment over his character being under attack and broke out into tears before he said, quote, "Today has been the worst day of my life." The whole situation caused John to become so paranoid that he started recording all phone calls which came into his office in order to protect himself. On January the 25th, John drafted a letter to William Dillard II, the CEO of Dillard's, in which he expressed his dissatisfaction with how the company was questioning CDI's integrity and wrote this unflattering passage about James Freeman, quote, "For Freeman to come down here and say we are dishonest, and for you to sit here and not say anything, hurt us to the core. We have never been so offended in our lives," end quote. John's original plan was to personally hand-deliver this letter to Dillard, but after having a conversation with William Clark, John calmed down, and William assured him that he would perform his own review of the letter before it was forwarded to Dillard. But of course, John went missing before this could happen. Well, Dillard's external audit still continued in John's absence, and they ultimately reached the conclusion that John had done a very impressive and thorough job with his bookkeeping. On February the 28th, CDI and Dillard's released this joint statement to the media, quote, "Neither Dillard's nor CDI believe any money was misappropriated by John Glasgow or any other member of CDI's management," end quote. The day after the statement was made, Melinda agreed to publicly release a copy of the letter that John had written to William Dillard II prior to his disappearance in order to present a clear picture of the tensions between Dillard's and CDI. The Glasgows had enlisted their family attorney, Chip Welch, to function as their spokesperson to the media, and he stated, quote, "I'm certainly not suggesting anybody did anything to him from Dillard's, but maybe this shed some light on why he may have gone missing and some people who ought to be asked questions about their whereabouts when they last saw him," end quote. Well, 1 month after telling the media that they did not believe any money was misappropriated by CDI, Dillard's released a restatement of earnings to the Securities and Exchange Commission, which dated back 7 years. Dillard's admitted that they had overstated their profits by $10.1 million, but blamed CDI for this error, alleging that the company had been overbilling Dillard's for construction jobs on their stores. For their part, CDI insisted that Dillard's had made the error when they recorded their share of CDI's profits, and William Clark publicly absolved John of any responsibility in what might have happened, stating, quote, "John was only doing what he was directed to do and doing it correctly. He had not made any of the decisions that were upsetting the Dillard's. He had not done anything wrong or illegal," end quote. In August of that year, CDI and Dillard's finally made an agreement in which Dillard's would retain their 50% ownership in CDI, while the Clark family sold off its 50% ownership to a management group for $9.8 million. While William Clark made an attempt to purchase CDI, his offer was rejected by Dillard's, so Clark resigned as CEO and left the company in January of 2009. 3 years eventually passed, and since John could still not be found, Melinda filed a formal request in Pulaski County Circuit Court in February of 2011, asking that John be declared legally dead, and a judge formally agreed to the request on April the 13th. However, there would be a new development in January of 2012 when it was announced that the Little Rock Police Department had been contacted by the attorney of a 43-year-old inmate named Jonathan Bronner, who was serving time at the Faulkner County Jail. On the morning of July the 31st, 2009, two men named David Newkirk and J.C. Chapman had attempted to kidnap a commodities broker named Jim Davin while he was leaving his rural home in Conway County. But Davin fought the two men off and cried for help, which prompted Davin's stepson to yell out the window that he had a gun. When Chapman pulled out a gun and pointed it towards the house, the stepson responded by fatally shooting Chapman through his left eye. While Newkirk took off into the woods and ran away, he was soon captured by the police. Newkirk then revealed that the mastermind behind this kidnapping plot was Jonathan Bronner, a former employee from Davin's commodities brokerage who was fired after he was caught writing himself checks from a company account. Bronner had hired Newkirk and Chapman to abduct Davin, and the plan was to force him to transfer $3 million from his firm's client accounts into some offshore accounts which Bronner had set up. This obviously didn't work out, and after he was taken into custody, Bronner agreed to a deal in which he would plead guilty to robbery and testify against his co-conspirators in exchange for a light sentence. Bronner served less than a year in a prison boot camp before he was paroled, but he was rearrested in October of 2010 for stalking his ex-wife, and subsequently convicted of the crime at trial. Bronner remained incarcerated in the Faulkner County Jail to await his sentencing hearing when he suddenly came forward and told police that he had information about John Glasgow's disappearance and knew the location of his body. According to Bronner, he owed money to some quote-unquote thugs, so in exchange for wiping out his debt, they sought Bronner's assistance with helping them bury John's body in a bean field near the town of England, which is located in Lenoke County, just east of Little Rock. Bronner passed a polygraph test when he shared his story and led police to this bean field, but even though a search and a dig was performed, nothing could be found. Investigators began to doubt the credibility of Bronner's story and suspected that he was providing false information about the Glasgow case in hopes of getting a reduced sentence on the stalking conviction. If so, the strategy did not work, as Bronner received a 10-year sentence for stalking, as well as an additional 96 months for violating his probation. John would continue to remain a missing person, but on March 11, 2015, a pair of hikers discovered a partial skull at the base of a cliff located on Pettigean Mountain, about 150 yards off Red Bluff Drive. The skull was immediately sent to the Arkansas State Crime Lab, and the following day, dental records were used to positively identify it as belonging to John Glasgow, officially confirming that he was deceased. A further search of the area would turn up additional skeletal remains on a shelf of rock about 200 yards south from where the skull was found, as well as clothing containing John's wallet, which had his driver's license and a personal credit card. This area was only about a mile from the parking lot of the Mather Lodge, and considered to be so remote and rugged that hikers were generally urged to avoid going there, and it seemed likely that John's remains had been scattered by animals, which is why his skull was found in a different spot. Since there were no signs of trauma to the skull, the medical examiner was unable to determine John's cause of death, so it would be classified as undetermined. When Conway County Sheriff Mike Smith was asked by the press if this was now a criminal case, he replied, quote, "Absolutely not. This has always been conducted as a missing persons case. The investigation is now done. I'm definitely comfortable with it being a missing person found and case closed," end quote. However, Sheriff Smith did confirm that the office would be willing to investigate new leads if anyone came forward with information. By contrast, when Roger Glasgow spoke to the media, he expressed his belief that John was the victim of foul play, but since the discovery of his remains, no new evidence has emerged to conclusively prove that a homicide took place, and the circumstances surrounding John's death remain shrouded in mystery. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So like I mentioned during the intro, this was one of the very first episodes of Disappeared that I recall watching, and it definitely played a role in getting me hooked on the show because I found the case to be so perplexing. At the time, it still couldn't be conclusively determined if John Glasgow himself drove his SUV to Mather Lodge, and if he ever set foot in Pettigean State Park, but since his remains would be found there about 5 years after the Disappeared episode originally aired, it now seems likely that he drove there on his own accord. But of course, the discovery of John's remains didn't solve the mystery, since we don't know the circumstances of how he died or why he was there to begin with. It was about a year after they featured John's case when Disappeared released an episode about the 2005 disappearance of Ray Grecar, which I also covered on episode number 268 of The Trail Went Cold. You can definitely see a number of parallels between the two cases, as both victims were middle-aged white males who are generally not in the top demographic for missing persons, and their abandoned vehicles were found at a location which was over an hour's drive away from their homes. John Glasgow and Ray Grecar were both very well-respected individuals with successful careers and happy marriages, and in each case, it's been theorized that the victim could have been murdered over something that was related to their job. However, since there is no direct evidence of foul play in either case, suicide has also been pushed forward as a possibility. Since Ray Grecar is still a missing person, there's a lot more ambiguity in his case, but while we do have John Glasgow's remains, his cause of death is officially considered to be undetermined. However, given the stress he was experiencing in his life at that time, you can't discount the idea that John could have decided to travel to a faraway location in order to end his own life, even though his loved ones have continually insisted he was not suicidal. These kind of missing persons cases are always so frustrating, because even though the authorities have stated that they are still willing to explore new leads if they come their way, it does not sound like they are actively investigating John's death, and it is not a top priority for them. And this opens up a major dilemma for John's loved ones. If his death was actually a suicide, or even some sort of tragic accident, and there was no one around to witness the event, How can they ever find out for certain? As far as I can tell, there hasn't been any new media coverage of this story since John's remains were found 9 years ago, which makes me think that there haven't been any developments in the investigation in quite some time. If John's death was a suicide, then the most prominent theory is that he may have done something illegal or unethical during his tenure as chief financial officer at CDI Contractors, and if he feared this was going to be uncovered during the external audit which was taking place, John decided to take his own life to avoid the shame and scandal of the whole situation. Now, about a month after John went missing, both CDI and Dillard's, the company who had been directing suspicion towards John in the first place, released a joint statement in which they confirmed that neither John nor anyone from CDI had misappropriated any funds, so it does not sound like they found any evidence that John did anything wrong. But here's where it starts to get confusing. About 1 month after making this statement, Dillard's releases a restatement of earnings in which they admit that they overstated their profits by $10.1 million, but passed all the blame to CDI, alleging that this was the result of them overbilling Dillard's for construction jobs. This seems to be in direct contradiction to Dillard's original statement that no one from CDI had misappropriated any funds, but they never specifically blamed John for this error or accused him of doing anything wrong. For his part, CDI CEO William Clark confirmed that even if this overbilling had taken place, it wouldn't have been John's fault, since he was simply doing what he was told to do and was likely unaware that anything was amiss. And it's also possible that CDI was not even at fault at all, and the mistake was made by Dillard's. I think the confusion about this situation stems from the fact that even though Dillard's hired CDI to perform construction jobs for them, they had joint partnership of the company. One reason that Dillard's may have overstated their profits is because they were reporting construction expenses on their financial statements that were technically revenues for CDI. But because of the joint partnership, Dillard's counted these transactions as both an expense and a revenue, which is very misleading, and made their profits seem higher than they really were. And if this is what happened, the fault certainly wouldn't lie with John. James Freeman, the Dillard's CFO who allegedly accused John of misappropriating funds, had a reputation for being a harsh manager who was tough on his employees, so when he acted this way towards John, perhaps he was overcompensating for the fact that his own company was the one making mistakes and doing unethical things. Regardless, even if John never did anything wrong, it sounds like he took Freeman's accusations very personally, but I guess the big question is, would this situation have been serious enough to drive him to suicide? Or alternatively, if something illegal was going on, could things have escalated into murder? Well, when the Disappeared episode aired, the head of the original search and rescue team was interviewed, and he expressed his belief that John was not in Pettigean State Park. But of course, I've covered so many cases on this podcast where an extensive search effort is performed for a missing person in a remote wilderness area and nothing is found, only for someone to stumble upon the victim's remains in the exact same area years after the fact. The section of the part where John's remains turned up was considered to be very rugged and potentially dangerous, which is why hikers were discouraged from venturing there, so I can understand why the remains could have been missed during the original search effort. In fact, I suppose we should consider ourselves lucky that a pair of hikers decided to be daring and ignore the advice about avoiding the area, because otherwise, who knows how long John's remains would have gone undiscovered. I know that the bloodhounds from the original search effort had trouble tracking John's scent from his SUV into the park, which caused speculation that he may have left in another vehicle or was not even the person who drove the SUV there to begin with. However, this may have been due to the fact that heavy winds went through the area at that time, which makes it all the more difficult for bloodhounds to detect a scent. In retrospect, I don't think I put much stock into the findings of Quincy, the bloodhound from the VK9 Scent-Specific Search and Recovery Unit, who supposedly tracked John's scent through some locations in Russellville, such as a gas station, motel, and Waffle House. This was done after some eyewitnesses supposedly spotted John in Russellville, but given that his remains were ultimately found in the park, only about a mile from where he abandoned his SUV at the Mather Lodge, I think the witnesses were probably mistaken and the findings from Quincy were unreliable. Since they're not that far apart, I suppose it's possible that when John left Little Rock, he could have made a side trip to Russellville before he drove to the Mather Lodge, but I find that very unlikely. Now, it's been reported that Quincy detected John's scent at the driveway of the Dillard's corporate office in Little Rock, though this may have been due to the fact that John had gone there for a meeting about a month before he disappeared. But I suppose it's not completely impossible that John could have stopped by there on the same morning he left Little Rock. Remember, John's SUV was seen leaving his residence at 5:15 a.m., and his cell phone pinged off a tower in Conway County at 7:22 a.m. It technically should have taken John around 1 hour and 15 minutes to drive from his home to the Mather Lodge, so this leaves nearly an hour's worth of time which is unaccounted for. According to the electronic logs at the CDI office, John never went there that morning, so could John have spent this extra time stopping by the Dillard's corporate office? And if so, did this somehow play a role in his death? Now, if you believe there was foul play, you could assume the reason John's remains were missed during the original search effort at Pettigean State Park is because he was actually murdered at another location, and the responsible party subsequently brought his remains back to the park at a later time after the search took place. However, I find this extremely unlikely because, like I mentioned earlier, that particular section of the park is so rugged and difficult to access that it's not the ideal place to dispose of a body. So if John was murdered, this likely occurred after he entered the park with another person. Well, when John was still a missing person and no one knew where he was, there was not enough evidence to specifically lean towards homicide or suicide, but since John's remains were ultimately found only about a mile from his abandoned vehicle, we can definitely see warning signs pointing towards suicide. Of course, John's loved ones have repeatedly insisted that he was not suicidal and never would have taken his own life, which is the standard response from victims' friends and family members in cases like this. But the problem is that you can just never know what is really going on inside a suicidal person's mind. Logically, it does not seem to make much sense for someone to drive over an hour away from their home to a remote location in order to go through the act of taking their own life, but suicidal people can be unpredictable. I repeatedly mentioned this case on the podcast, but I must once again hearken back to the 1986 disappearance and suicide of Gail Delano, who traveled over 1,500 miles from Maine to Alabama in order to check into a hotel under a false name before she overdosed on pills. So if someone is capable of doing that, who's to say that John Glasgow wouldn't have driven 70 miles in order to do something similar? It would be one thing if John had no known ties to the area, but he had been to Pettigean State Park before, so perhaps he just felt this would be a peaceful and comforting place to end things. One of the most telling signs that John may have been planning suicide is the fact that he wrote down the numbers of his joint bank account and the combination to his home safe on a notepad which belonged to Melinda. While we can't be absolutely certain that John wrote those numbers down right before he left his house, the notepad was lying to some checks that John had filled out, which were dated from that morning. Since Melinda already knew the bank account number and the safe combination, she found it odd that John would write this information down, but what if he wanted to be absolutely certain that she was taken care of financially after he was gone? When Melinda opened the safe and found $11,400 in cash, she even acknowledged that this was more cash than she remembered being in there. All that being said, if John was taking these steps to protect Melinda, it also could have been because he feared his life was in danger and that something might happen to him, so it doesn't necessarily mean he was suicidal. I also find it interesting that when John's laptop case was found inside the SUV, it exclusively contained items which had been issued to him by CDI, including his laptop, cell phone, office key, company credit card, and company gas card. Yet John's personal debit card was found inside the glove compartment, and his personal credit card was still inside his wallet when his remains were found. I do not think that's a coincidence, and the disappeared episode even explored the idea that the company-issued items being grouped together in the laptop case could have been a symbolic gesture on John's part in order to send a message that he was walking away from his job for good. Now, I have to be delicate when analyzing potential motives for suicide here, as it's never been conclusively proven that John did anything illegal or unethical, so I don't want to needlessly smear a deceased victim's reputation. I know that virtually everyone who knew John would have referred to him as the most honest person they'd ever met. John was so honest that at one point, he received a $500 bonus for completing an anti-smoking program and quitting cigarettes, but when he started smoking again, he actually went so far as to pay that money back. It's also worth noting that one of the main reasons that John was promoted to the position of CDI's chief financial officer is because the company's previous CFO had gradually been embezzling $1.3 million, and since he was the CDI's comptroller at the time, John was able to uncover evidence of the scheme and immediately turned it over to the higher-ups. At the time he disappeared, John was doing very well financially, as he had no debt, and his house and car were both paid off, so yeah, on the surface, he does not fit the profile of someone who would embezzle money or do anything to cook his employer's books, as I'm sure he knew better than anyone that this sort of thing will get you caught eventually. Well, regardless of whether or not John had any secrets, it sounds like he became pretty stressed out over the external audit of CDI and the alleged character attacks from Dillard's CFO, James Freeman, who implied that John would be the fall guy if anything illegal was uncovered during this audit. According to Melinda, John took the whole situation so hard that he broke out into tears, and she said that during their 16 years of marriage, the only other time she had ever seen John cry like that was when his mother died. Of course, if John had done something wrong and knew that the walls were closing in on him and his reputation was going to be ruined, I can totally understand this emotional reaction. But once again, when the audit was completed, CDI and Dillard's both publicly stated that they found nothing to indicate that John had perpetuated any financial malfeasance. I will add the disclaimer that if anything incriminating was uncovered about John, I do have to wonder if the authorities would elect not to release this information publicly in order to preserve his reputation now that he was deceased. But since we've never heard anything to indicate that John did anything illegal or unethical, let's continue to move forward under the assumption that he really was as honest as he appeared to be. I have to wonder that if even John didn't do anything wrong, the stress surrounding the audit and the accusations from James Freeman were still enough to drive him to suicide. Perhaps John had the awful feeling that CDI had engaged in unethical practices, and even if he did not know about them, he feared that his position as CFO was going to make him the fall guy and cause him to get into trouble for something that happened on his watch. While some people would be able to handle this sort of scrutiny, perhaps John had issues with depression or other undiagnosed mental health issues which he never talked about, and that's why this situation hit him so hard. One reason that suicide has been explored as a potential option in the Ray Grecar case is because he had previously lost a brother to suicide, and while Ray was set to retire and had plans for the future, those who knew him noticed that he seemed to be sleeping a lot more frequently than usual prior to his disappearance, which could have been a sign of depression. On the day before John went missing, he came home from work during his lunch break, and Melinda felt that he seemed to be exhausted and distracted. He also took a nap while he was there, and it was apparently out of character for John to do something like that during a workday. So this could also be construed as a sign that he was depressed and had reached his breaking point. Of course, if John did opt for suicide, there's still a big unanswered question about his manner of death. Given that his skull was found at the base of a cliff, the most obvious theory is that John intentionally jumped to his death. The issue is that there was no sign of trauma to John's skull, so I guess it's a question about whether he could have landed in a certain way which did not leave any noticeable damage. Of course, this is not the most logical way to end one's own life, because if John jumped from the cliff and the fall did not kill him, then he would have had to have spent the last portion of his life lying around in excruciating pain, and given the remoteness of the location, no one would have heard his cries for help. If John was feeling suicidal, then there were definitely closer locations he could have gone in order to jump off a high place, such as the Junction Bridge, which runs over the Arkansas River in Little Rock. This could have saved John from having to make a 70-mile drive, but perhaps he just felt that Petit Jean State Park was a peaceful, comfortable place and was remote enough that his loved ones would never find him or learn about his suicide. Of course, another possibility is that due to all the stress he was experiencing, John needed some solitude, so he decided to get up extra early in order to drive to the park and go on a hike to clear his head. Once he completed his hike, perhaps John was even planning to drive back to Little Rock and go to work at his office as usual, but he ventured into this rugged section of the park and slipped and died via an accidental fall off a cliff. Now, because there is no conclusive evidence pointing in any direction, I cannot rule out the possibility that John was murdered, but how would these events have played out? The last time Melinda saw John, he was asleep in a chair in front of the TV when she went to bed at 10:30 p.m., and by the time she woke up the following morning, John was already gone. Even though John's company-issued cell phone pinged off a tower, he never actually used the phone to make or receive any calls that morning or the previous night. As far as I know, investigators never found records of any phone calls or emails to indicate that John had made arrangements to meet with anyone after he left his house. While John's neighbors saw his SUV driving away at 5:15 a.m., he could not actually confirm seeing John at the wheel, so I guess it's not impossible that someone else could have shown up at the Glasgow residence that morning and they both left together, or John was forcibly abducted. I don't find the abduction scenario all that plausible, but I guess this would be a good time to mention Jonathan Bronner again, since he attempted to hire two people to abduct another man from his home in Conway County just a year and a half after John went missing. Bronner claimed that some other people had enlisted his help to bury John's body, but knowing what we know now, I think it's safe to say that Bronner was full of it. He said that John was buried in a bean field, but it turned out his remains were not buried at all, and found in the same park where his SUV was abandoned, so it seems obvious that Bronner probably heard about John's disappearance in the media and decided to use it to feed the authorities false information in hopes that he would get a reduced sentence on his stalking conviction. After all, Bronner claimed that he was hired to bury John's body, but as far as I can tell, he never actually revealed who supposedly hired him. The only foul play scenario that makes sense is if John made arrangements to meet someone at Petit Jean State Park, or alternatively, drove to the park with them. If John went elsewhere to pick someone up, that could explain why it took him 2 hours to drive to Conway County rather than the standard time of 75 minutes. John then went out into the trail with this person, or persons, but for reasons unknown, they proceeded to kill John and shoved his body off a cliff. But this scenario still doesn't explain why John would travel to this park to begin with. The one thing which gives me pause and makes me think that a crime was committed and that someone else was in the SUV is the fact that the authorities cannot recover any usable fingerprints. They couldn't find any prints belonging to John, which is quite unusual, given that he owned the vehicle. However, it must be clarified that law enforcement never specifically said that the SUV had been wiped clean, only that there were no usable prints. So this could mean that they were still smudged or partial prints on the vehicle, but nothing identifiable. If investigators had specifically used the phrase wiped clean, I would take that as a good sign that a third party was somehow involved, but the lack of prints may be more of a freak occurrence than anything. Alternatively, another possible explanation is that if John was planning suicide, he could have attempted to wipe the prints from the SUV himself in order to give off the false impression that he was the victim of a homicide. My main issue with believing that John was the victim of foul play is that not only are we lacking an explanation for why they traveled to Petit Jean State Park, but there doesn't seem to be any apparent motive either. I mentioned earlier that the Glasgow family's attorney, Chip Welch, made a cryptic statement about how even though he wasn't suggesting that anyone from Dillard's did anything to John, certain people needed to be asked questions about their whereabouts when they last saw him. But even if there was some shady business going on between Dillard's and CDI involving such practices as overbilling, would it really have been serious enough to commit murder? Remember, John had already turned in one CFO who was embezzling money, so if he found any evidence of illegal activity in this situation, I'm sure he wouldn't have hesitated to tell someone. In the days prior to his disappearance, John had drafted a letter to the CEO of Dillard's expressing his disappointment about the lack of trust they seemed to have with CDI, but there was nothing to indicate that John had uncovered any malfeasance. After a 27-year career with Dillard's, James Freeman retired as their CFO in 2015, and while he may not have been the nicest person in the world and treated John quite rudely, that's still a far cry from being a murderer. Overall, if John was suffering from mental health issues at this point, then I find it more believable that this whole situation with Dillard's may have driven him over the edge, rather than there being an organized conspiracy to kill him. If by chance John was murdered by someone, then I have a feeling it may have been over something which was unrelated to this whole situation. Don't get me wrong, there are enough unusual details about this case that I certainly won't say that I'm 100% completely behind the suicide theory, but of all the scenarios in this case, it is the one which seems to make the most sense. But it is a horrible situation for John's loved ones, and I can understand why they would want to believe that he was the victim of foul play. If there's a killer out there somewhere who can be arrested and charged with murder, then at least there's a chance of John's family finally learning the full truth about what happened. But if John traveled to Petit Jean State Park and killed himself with no witnesses around, then there's no chance of finding out the truth, and everyone who loved and cared about him will have to continue living the rest of their lives in uncertainty. However, the authorities have stated that they are willing to investigate any new leads if they receive them, so the case is not completely closed. So if by chance you happen to have any information about the unexplained death of John Glasgow, please contact the Conway County Sheriff's Office at 501-354-2411. That's 501-354-2411. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 6 years, our Patreon page has released nearly 70 exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3. This past month, I released a bonus episode about the disappearance of Dee Dee Rosenthal, who was the apparent victim of a murder, but even after her supposed killer confessed, her remains were never found. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, cover an odd missing persons case, the 1998 disappearance of 98-year-old Walter Dunson. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have over 60 of these commentary tracks in our archives. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are John Laurie H., Kate, Amanda L., and Ian B. Thank you all so much for your support. I wanted to remind everyone that The Trail Went Cold has been booked to appear on Podcast Row at two separate CrimeCon events. The American CrimeCon, which is taking place at the end of this month at the Gaylord Opryland Hotel in Nashville from May the 31st until June the 2nd, and CrimeCon UK, which is taking place at 133 Houndsditch in London on September the 21st and 22nd. If you would like to purchase tickets, we have a specialized promo code to get a 10% discount at both events, so please visit crimecon.com or crimecon.co.uk and use the promo code COOL24. Once again, that's crimecon.com and crimecon.co.uk, and the promo code is COOL24 for 10% off tickets to both events. I just want to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶